Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan. For my introduction, I want to tell you about some things that are on my mind and that are going to be appearing on my websites in the next week or so. And disturbingly, it's about lobotomy and it's about electroshock. Lobotomy is making a comeback in North America. Several places in Canada are doing psychosurgery. I'm not sure yet about the U.S. We know that there's been ongoing projects at Harvard and Brown. A recent publication that came out of Canada and then it was followed up with an excellent newspaper coverage, quoting my view, which is a really new thing that wouldn't have happened a decade or two ago in regard to psychosurgery. Times have changed. The study out of Quebec City followed up a group of people whose brains were mutilated 7 years later. And in these mutilations, a cannula was put through each side of the head, through a hole in the head, and plain old wires, like slicing and dicing, were passed through the brain and then swished around at their base. The authors themselves described that their aim was to make a slice more than half an inch across in an area called the anterior capsule, which is a major trunk of connections between the neurons in the frontal lobes and lower in the brain in the limbic system, the emotion regulating system. This is a good old-fashioned lobotomy. It's done right next to the frontal lobes. They followed up these people 7 years later by having untrained questioners ask them a questionnaire to list the symptoms that they had of OCD. These patients had an intractable OCD. 7 years later, simple questions, 10 question items, and about a third of them seemed to list fewer than they did 7 years earlier. Absolutely worthless. No control group. And not asking a single question about what we know lobotomy does to the brain and mind. Nothing that would have tested whether these people even remember having had surgery on their brains. No questions asking these people to maybe say two or three sentences about themselves, which post-psychosurgery, post-lobotomy patients can barely speak about themselves. They can't say, oh, yes, I'm very interested in fishing and hunting, or I like to play chess, or I'm looking forward to the summer. And, you know, I do have some struggles at home and the family. They can't talk like that because self-reflection and self-insight has been destroyed. Nothing about that, even though there are big studies that confirm that. It's just a simple thing of a surgeon liking to mutilate brains and doing it. And it's an irresistible urge for a lot of these guys. And women, I suppose, as well. I'm going to be putting out a blog in the next week or two about that with citations to what lobotomy really does and calling for people throughout the world to send me any information they have, any information about ongoing lobotomy and psychosurgery. As some of you know, and as is described in the book about my work, The Conscience of Psychiatry, it's called, I took about 5 or 6 years out of my life in the early 70s to stop the return of psychosurgery. And I want to make sure it doesn't get a strong foothold again. By the way, in reviewing this stuff all over again, I found a quote from 1992 from the head of neurosurgery at Johns Hopkins, talking about how much they want to bring back psychosurgery in the 1990s and in order to do so, they have to tell the Peter Breggins of the world where to go. And so it's a wonderful quote. Meanwhile, as I've mentioned earlier, I've been appalled by the numbers of damaged people I've been seeing in my consultation work and my forensic work from electroshock. And within the week now, I hope, we're going to have up for the first time a resource center where anybody can go and first get a simple, colorful brochure that you can give to a patient or a family member or a lawyer about how bad shock treatment is, and then a website that has introductory information, and then over 125 scientific articles that you can retrieve all free of charge to educate yourself or anybody else about what's going on with shock treatment. Now it's beginning to look like I may have to do the same thing with psychosurgery. But that appears to be my appointed task this lifetime, and we will continue with it. So look in the next week or two on my website or on the web in general for a new blog on psychosurgery and lobotomy, and also for these incredible pages into which myself and my researcher Ian and my wife Ginger and my assistant Missy have put hundreds of hours to set up this free page on shock treatment. Well, to happier thoughts, towards the opposite of shock treatment. My guest today, a man that I met only in passing quite some time back, his name is Michael Ostrolenk, O-S-T-R-O-L-E-N-K, Michael Ostrolenk. And he can help me with the pronunciation if I've not done a perfect job. He has a master's degree in transpersonal counseling psychology. Got that from the John F. Kennedy University. And he's got a BA in government. And these two interests intertwine in a very complex career in which, on the one hand, he's a therapist, a psychotherapist. And he also does a training that he could tell you about, based on the kind of training SEALs go through, and it's called SEAL Fit, the Unbeatable Mind Academy. His interest in government is a civil libertarian interest, so he's involved in programs and projects on behalf of liberty, including being co-founder and national director of the Liberty Coalition and a number of related organizations. And he's written widely, from USA Today to the American Conservative Magazine. When we chatted last night, he was in the process, I think, of recovering from or enjoying the after effects of sensory deprivation floating, which Michael will perhaps soon tell you about. Welcome to the and he has his own radio show. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Thank you, Peter. It's an honor to be here.
Well, I'm delighted to have you. Listen, you could just fly, so start fluttering and take off in some direction or another here.
Certainly. Well, you brought up the sensory deprivation tank, and when you and I spoke last night, I was actually on my way home from 2 hours of floating. And for folks who don't know anything about sensory deprivation tanks or flotation tanks, more commonly termed, it's a tank that deprives you of your senses, basically. There's no light, there's no sound. You're sitting in about 18 inches of water with about 98 Epsom salt solution, so it's like floating in the Dead Sea, so you're actually floating. And it's very, very interesting because you're deprived of sensory data, those parts of your brain that usually process that type of information get the opportunity to relax a bit. Your musculature gets relaxed because you're floating. You're in Epsom salt, and the magnesium has a positive effect on the musculature as well. So just generally speaking, it's a very relaxing experience. And if you're fortunate, and I've been fortunate at times, you can kind of get into hypnagogic states, kind of like dreamlike states, and access some really interesting unconscious material in your own unconscious, and interesting bodily states as well. And it's a great experience. So if you or any of your listeners have the opportunity, I encourage you to try it out. And you consider it this way: it's a way of getting into a meditative state, but much easier than sitting zazen, for instance, because you're floating.
Michael, you have to tell people what a hypnagogic state is, having experienced some of that. I know what it is, and remember reading about it when I was 18, 19 years old, and trying to figure out what in the world was I experiencing as I fell asleep. Tell folks about it, maybe a little more about what your experience was like, if you're comfortable with that.
Certainly. So it's dreamlike states. So there is thinking in various spiritual traditions and various schools of psychology, and this is not agreed upon throughout all schools of psychology, including conventional psychology, that accessing these dreamlike states, and you're awake, so it's not like you're in sleep, you're doing so, but you're consciously aware. So you're a witness to the dreamlike states, which means that you can have you're able to process the dreamlike material, but consciously. So it's not like you wake up in the morning and you're like, "Well, I think I had a dream. I vaguely remember bits and pieces of it." It's more like you're there experiencing whatever you experience in the dreamlike state, but quite conscious of it. And depending what school of psychology you come from, you could be accessing unconscious materials that could prove useful to your own personal growth and development and, ability to connect with other people. That's kind of the school of psychology I would come from, and thinking that these states are quite useful. And, that's just one state of many that we actually studied when I studied transpersonal psychology in graduate school.
Now, it's hypnagogic images are common when falling asleep.
Right.
I, for many years in college and somewhat in the end of high school, I would have an experience when I fell asleep, but I wasn't asleep, and it was just like you were saying, I could process to some extent, and actually was able to get myself back into the experience when it would start to fade. And the experience was that the room would develop a golden glow, and I would be reading a great book that had within it some meaning of just great importance. And I would be reaching for that importance, but I would awaken. And a few times I tried to get back in, and I couldn't get to the meaning, the great meaning. And I think as I went into training pre-med shortly after that, I think I didn't have them anymore. And I know now, Michael, that if I'm particularly in touch with living in a spiritual world and my own spiritual nature, that colors improve, and there's almost like a golden hue, like a golden sunglasses, only better. That I experience. Now, I don't know if you want to make anything out of that, but I've puzzled over that over the years and thought one thing and another about it.
Well, my two quick comments would be the human mind's amazing, and we know so little about
yes.
it. There are some interesting technologies, and I mean technologies not in the scientific modern sense, but yoga, meditation, various practices like that that go back hundreds and thousands of years, which have been used to explore the mind. And, human beings are meaning-making creatures, so, we have experiences and then we make meaning of those experiences, and usually those meanings are trapped in our culture or informed by our culture. So, it's a great time to be alive because we can kind of step back and look at our own minds and look at our own cultures and explore these things and start having the conversations and continue to have the conversations such as the one that you and I are now having.
You're going to spare me any comment on the experience, it sounds like. So go ahead and tell us some more about your own work and where it's going.
Well, I wear two different hats, and ultimately in my mind I see them as one and the same. But for discussion purposes, I'll go into two different hats. So I do what I call transpartisan public policy. Transpartisan has various meanings, but for purposes of this conversation, let's just say it's bridge building between various perspectives, in this case political perspectives, but it doesn't have to be limited to politics. So I do a lot of work where I bring liberals, conservatives, libertarians, progressives together for common purposes. I've done transparency in government. I've done civil liberties. I've done some anti-war stuff. I'm not against wars. I'm just against most stupid wars. I'm against stupid wars and wars that are unconstitutional, and unfortunately, we've been surrounded by quite a few of those in the recent past. I've done stuff on health freedom / medical freedom. So there's a wide variety of issues that if you actually ignore mainstream talking head television and radio and the political parties themselves, that there is a lot of common ground, a lot of conversations going on behind the scenes, and a lot of efforts to promote a more just, fair, and free country. So that's the transpartisan work. The other hat that I work is I'm a master coach at something called Seal Fit Unbeatable Mind Academy. I can tell you a little bit more about that, or do you want to jump further back and talk more about the transpartisan work?
Oh, golly. One thing that struck me about the transpartisan work is, wow, what a field day you must be having with PRISM and the other programs going on to keep track of all of our phone calls, if not the contents of who they're to and how long they lasted and their frequency and maybe the contents of emails and goodness knows what else, all completely secret except to those who rule our lives in the Senate, the House, and the executive branch.
Yeah, it's really interesting, and this is a reason I think it's useful to have a transpartisan perspective. And I hold it's a perspective, but what I attempt to do in the people that I work with in the transpartisan philosophical space is to recognize the validity in the various worldviews and create a kind of a larger picture of how people think about the world, including these different perspectives, and creating processes so people can get along and take decisions that better everyone. Now, it's interesting to take that type of thinking and apply it to the recent NSA, FBI revelations, because they're actually not so recent. I've been working on civil liberties since soon thereafter 9/11. We had revelations 2005, 2006 about some of these similar type of programs. Of course, it was under Bush, it wasn't under Obama, different names. But the similar type of surveillance and spying and a whole host of other efforts by the federal government, including fusion centers and Real ID, which is a national identification card, E-Verify. There are a lot of secure flight, as an example. There are a lot of surveillance tracking systems in place. And it's fascinating to watch because when it was under Bush, there were a lot of Democrats and progressives who came out strongly against it, and a lot of Republicans and conservatives defended Bush. And so you see somewhat the reverse happening now that it's Obama's, and he's a Democrat. But that's not completely true. There are a lot of people who I would say are less partisan and more principled, whether they're progressive, liberal, libertarian, or conservative. And it doesn't matter who's in power. They recognize that if something's wrong, it's wrong. If it's right, it's right. And you've got to call out, as you see it. So there have been transpartisan coalitions that have been together for over 10 years now, working to make reforms to these various programs or get rid of these various programs ultimately.
Is the news that's going on now, has it changed your life much? Are you in the middle of it in some way?
I'm in the middle of it. I mean, it's an issue that I work on. I work on a wide variety of issues on the policy side. So I'm also working in a transpartisan coalition on rational cuts to the Pentagon, Pentagon spending issues. And it's interesting because, no one's going to know this because the NSA issue is now up as well as the IRS issue. But the NDAA, which is the National Defense Authorization Act, is now being debated this week. And there's a lot of good amendments that are going to hopefully be added in and voted on, which would reduce spending, get rid of some wasteful programs, reform the Pentagon. But you're not going to hear about it. So unfortunately, like most things in D.C., it's just going to fly by, and hopefully we'll have some good wins, and we'll probably take a few losses. And I don't know if you recall this, but I think it was last year's or maybe the year before, the NDAA had a provision in it which was an indefinite detention provision, which allows either the U.S. military or the FBI to indefinitely detain American citizens on U.S. soil. Which,
yes,
you know,
I remember that. It struck me as bizarre and terrifying.
Bizarre, terrifying, you know, anti-American. I mean, it completely violates everything that we as a country should be standing for, and what we basically fought a revolution of, you know, against the United Kingdom, the Brits. Yeah, very disturbing. You know, and this year, I think Representative Mosh and a few others, Smith, will be introducing an amendment. Hopefully it will pass. Most likely it won't, unfortunately, which would repeal those provisions. Because, you know, we're supposed to have due process. No one should be detained indefinitely, especially as American citizens. But anyone on American soil should have due process. And as you know, it's very, very dangerous to allow the military to operate as a tool for law enforcement here in the States. I mean, there has been limitations on its use domestically, and those limitations should actually be strengthened and not weakened.
Yeah, the founders were very worried about ever having a standing army.
Yeah.
We sure do have a standing army.
Right, no, that's very true.
Well, this is all very, very interesting. Do we have any idea how many people have been locked up indefinitely under those provisions?
I'm under the impression that they have not been used yet here in the States, and I'm guessing they haven't. Like, I've not heard that they have been, and I'm guessing they have not been, which is good. But it's still, whether it's used or not, it's, from my perspective, and I would guess yours, inappropriate for the federal government to have that kind of power. Because, you know, Although Obama might not use it today, he might use it next year, or whoever precedes him as the president, whether it's a Republican or Democrat, you know, those powers could be used. And most likely at some point in the future will be used. That's why they should not exist.
Yeah, powers that exist are going to get used. There'll always be somebody who wants to exert a new form of coercion and control.
Right.
May not even be an elected president. Maybe it's the president, the vice president, or have been shot, and it's the next in line, or the next in line. I mean, you don't know who, or it could be covert without the knowledge even of the president and the vice president, and so on. So, wow.
Yeah, I think it perverts our relationship to our government. You know, we are supposed to be citizens in a republic, and all these powers make us subjects in a state, which is just completely back-assward.
You know, I got to some of the emphasis that you have in your life on the individual rights and civil liberties. I got to it, oddly enough, in many ways, through doing therapy and realizing that I believed completely in the autonomy of my patients. I never wanted to lock anybody up against their will. I wanted to encourage their personal responsibility. And I did all that without a political understanding of how much these issues are actually part and parcel of the American Constitution and Bill of Rights and traditions of the individual and freedom and personal responsibility. So I've been making somewhat of a similar integration to yours, started with therapy, and then I started to read more, obviously, to learn more about it. How did you get interested in all of this? Were you interested in the human rights issues, the individual rights issues before you became a therapist or after?
No, before. You know, I was fortunate to be born and raised
major,
in Northern Virginia. So I lived in the D.C. metro area. Mm-hmm. So I always had two major influences in my life. I was always around people in government, politics. You know, that was kind of always around in the air. And I grew up in a household which, you know, interestingly enough, my father was conservative, my mother is liberal. But individual liberty and freedom were kind of key to their operating philosophies. So, you know, I grew up with that type of thinking embedded in me. And I also had a strong interest since I was like 9 or 10 in what we might call the alternatives, alternative philosophy, alternative spirituality, alternative psychology, alternative medicine. A lot of these things are now more mainstream, but you know, this is a long time ago. And when you study like some of these alternative schools of psychology and alternative schools of medicine, it does require and necessitate a free individual to act for the better of their own health and well-being. So, you know, there's kind of the subjective personal stance and then the objective rights thing, and they both seem to come together well in my thinking over time, especially as I became an adult.
It's very interesting because you're obviously a very rational person and a very logical person. You speak precisely and you think with great clarity and logic. And I'm not used to finding in that person such an interest in the spiritual life and alternative approaches. You don't usually find that person floating in a tank somewhere. Your thoughts on that combination, Michael?
That's funny. Well, you know, I was lucky because as a kid, I had various learning and health troubles. My first therapist that I saw, and this is kind of telling of how I think and do things in the world, kind of obnoxiously in this case, I was around 9, and he was heavy, you know, overweight, obese, and smoking. And I said to him, you know, you can't quit smoking and cut your calories, and how can you help me? So I refused to see him, and he's a psychiatrist. My parents then sent me to a psychotherapist, Pat Lawson, here in D.C. metro area. And I was really lucky because she taught me biofeedback and guided imagery, got me into the martial arts, learned meditation. So, you know, she, thanks to her, I opened up in my insides, basically, for exploration. You know, so it was a nice combination of, you know, living in a very rational, Western-oriented, conventional household, and then having the kind of the spiritual, psychological side also being able to be developed. So, you know, it's kind of the integration of the two, rational and transrational, maybe.
And what is your therapy practice like?
Presently?
Yeah.
So I don't practice as a therapist. I do coaching. And the reason, there's an interesting story, at least interesting to me, why I stopped being a therapist. And this is, so I was licensed in the state of California many, many years ago and moved to the Washington, D.C. area.
How old are you? Michael, you keep saying many years ago. How old are you?
I'm 42.
That's not many years ago.
relatively speaking.
By the way, we're going to go to break in 2 minutes, so keep in mind that the music's going to start. But keep on talking. You were saying about an interesting story about therapy.
So I was going to transfer my license from California to the East Coast. Maryland, where I was residing, just passed a bill at the time to allow reciprocity. And after 18 months of waiting for them to actually put the regulations into effect, and they never did, I decided I couldn't wait for them to do so, to practice as a therapist, so I became, quote-unquote, a coach, which allowed me still to work with people, but not as a, you know, mental health expert, although I still had all my training and my hours, and I still kept my license, but I did it as a coach. And then, you know, presently I'm a coach at the Unbeatable Mind Academy for Seal Fit, which we can talk about after the break, if you'd like.
You know, I think the kind of, you've been way ahead of a lot of issues, and I think the country with the medicine getting more and more nationalized, that we're going to find a lot of therapists and saying to themselves, "I don't fit into this system. I can't keep up with the diagnostic demands and the paperwork to explain what I'm doing and all the numbers and the scrutinization." And I think more and more people are going to be looking to be coaches or to find other terms. They'll probably change over time. Eventually the coaches will get themselves licensed, I suppose, change over time. But people will be looking for niches of their own where they're just going to try to help people. And I think that's a very, very good direction. Thank you, Michael. When we come back, start out with telling folks how they can get in touch with you. And this is Dr. Peter Breggin. Welcome back for the second half. My guest, a very interesting man with wide-ranging interests, whom I want to give more of a platform to in the second half to talk about his interests. His name is Michael Ostrolenk, O-S-T-R-O-L-E-N-K. Welcome back, Michael.
Thanks, Peter. You asked me for my contact information.
Yeah. Yes.
So folks can check out my radio show at Ostrolenk, which you just spelled, ostrolenkradio.com. I have a blog, michaeldostrolenk.com. And if they want to just drop me an email, they can just send me an email at michaeldostrolenk@gmail.com. You mentioned something quite interesting, and I'd like to further elaborate on it, have a conversation around it about nationalization of healthcare and the possibility that therapists might continue to do their type of work, but under a new title, a new name. It seems to me that we're kind of in a transitional stage in our history, both as a country and perhaps various places in the world, going from industrial to post-industrial or industrial to information age, as you might call it. And industrial seems to be characterized by the centralization of power. I would say the corporate state, centralizing power. And the post-industrial, the information age, is about decentralizing power. And it's transition times can be really tough, and it's obviously tough for a lot of people, especially for people who are unemployed. But there are great opportunities now as, some of the hold that the corporate state has both physically and mentally on us kind of, is deteriorating. And human beings are more free to try new things. Our culture is evolving, growing, expanding, being more free. So there's a lot of really cool experiments going on, whether it's in psychology or whether it's in medicine, whether it's food production in terms of sustainable agriculture or education. So now is actually a really cool time to be alive, understanding the industrial systems. Because you went to medical school, you understand conventional medicine quite well, conventional psychiatry quite well, and also the opportunity to play around with some of these new ideas, whether it's the spiritual schools of psychology or somatics or sustainable agriculture or unschooling, deschooling, democratic free schooling. There's a lot of cool stuff going on out there. We're very fortunate as well as challenged.
Well, it's so interesting. Your distinction about the post-industrial age and the more anarchistic, creative, chaotic, my words, exploration and experimentation. And what we're witnessing at the same time with the government collecting all this huge data on us and these huge buildings and huge machines and so on, it's hopefully the dying gas of the corporate nation trying to control what has exploded in the information age. And it's going to be a struggle. I mean, this is
completely. It's going to be a struggle. Transition costs will be high. But I have hope, not Obama's kind of hope, but real hope, that the human spirit will prevail. And new forms of social organization and human expression and economics, a whole bunch of experiments are going on and will continue to go on. And I think some of the new models which will replace the older, antiquated industrial models, are now kind of getting their own feet and hopefully won't be destroyed by the old system so they can grow and hopefully replace as well as integrate. I'm in more of an evolutionist than a revolutionist. I don't want to say, violence and anarchy and stuff. There are value in the old models, which we need to integrate into the new models.
You know, when I was taking on the psychosurgery campaign in the early 1970s, I had to convince the mass media, magazines, newspapers, radio, television to cover it. I had to print out, I think at first with a mimeograph, if you can believe that, and later a not very good fax machine, hundreds and thousands, literally thousands of copies of materials critical of lobotomy and psychosurgery, and get them sent around and mail them to people who hopefully would mail them to other people. Now, I mean, it's such a different world of opportunity to let people know, once you've established some kind of an identity on the internet, some kind of identity in the world, you have so many more opportunities now to communicate with other human beings without being controlled by this corporate media and what you're calling the corporate state. It's very interesting to live through that transition now, and goodness knows what's coming and what's here and that I don't even know about.
Yeah, no, it's definitely exciting times. So, you know, I think that's a Chinese fortune cookie. May you live in exciting times or something along those lines, both a cursing and a blessing. So I think that's where we are. You know, you had asked me about the various work that I do, and, you know, I kind of went through some of the transpartisan work, and perhaps I can tap into and explain a little bit about my work at SealFit, if that would be okay.
Please.
So for my 40th birthday, which is just not too long ago, a couple years ago, trying to figure out what I wanted to do as a way of celebrating, and this is about a year before, so I was 39 at the time, I ran across something called SealFit, SealFit.com. And it's a program that's run by retired Navy SEALs. And occasionally they'll have some active guys who work the program when they're on breaks and stuff. And they offered two programs at the time. One was a three-week academy, which you live on campus. It's in San Diego. You train 12, 14 hours a day. And then you complete the 3 weeks with what is called a Kokoro camp. Kokoro is a Japanese word, means indomitable spirit. And it's a 50-hour camp. You stay up straight, no sleeping for 50 hours. It's very physically intense. And the idea is just to find your spirit, find your heart, what allows you to move through once your body and mind give out. You know, because after like 8 hours of training, your 10 hours, your body is starting to give out. Being awake for 24 hours and training, your mind starts getting a little loopy. But there's a part of you, if you're able to tap into it, that allows you to keep going. And with support from my wife, I decided that's what I wanted to do. So I trained up for it, and I did the three-week academy, and I did the 50-hour camp. Amazing experience. So the three-week academy, you know, a lot of physical training, Olympic lifting, running, swimming evolutions, water evolutions, hand-to-hand combat training, you know, all the physical stuff you could imagine that SEALs would throw at you, but also meditation. We did yoga, we did guided imagery, we did some leadership training. The Commander Mark Devine, who runs the program, is a fan of the work of Ken Wilber and his integral philosophy, which I'm familiar with, so we did that as well. We learned that. So, you know, it was a well-rounded, holistic leadership and individual training program. And the guys I trained with were, you know, three of them are now in BUDS, Basic Underwater Demolition SEALs. One guy just graduated. He actually graduates in 2 days. One guy just went in, and another one's halfway through the program. So, you know, it really prepares these young guys to be able to be successful when they try out for the SEALs or other military special operations units. But what was really cool is Commander Mark Devine and I stayed in contact afterwards, and he was realizing that more and more people who aren't 22 and going into the SEALs or trying to, or Army Special Forces, but, you know, wanted to learn to develop some of the same capacities, whether they're athletes, including elite athletes, but just everyday athletes or corporate leaders, hockey moms and dads. You know, there's a wide variety of people out there who can't take off 3 weeks and train 14 hours a day, but they want to develop themselves physically and mentally and emotionally. So he and asked me if I'd be willing to help him to develop and design what he ended up calling the Unbeatable Mind Academy, which is what I coach for now, and it's an online accelerated learning program. And we teach it based on the five mountains, which is what Commander Mark Divine developed. It's a physical mountain, which you can imagine, you know, the physical strength and coordination and endurance and stamina and work capacity. But we also have the mental mountain and the emotional mountain. So the emotional mountain is about self-awareness and awareness of others, managing internal states, you know, so you can be more mature in your relationships to other people. The mental mountain is about recognizing the various mental maps we use, you know, because we all construct reality in certain ways, and we think our construction of reality is reality, and we confuse the two. And if you can learn to play around with your mental maps, you get a little bit more freedom in your life. Intuition is one of the mountains, so we train that. And then heart, or kokoro. So it's a well-rounded, integrated, holistic training program, and I'm thrilled to be part of it. So that's my other hat, is working with individuals at this program.
So you're in super physical and mental shape.
I try to be. I mean, I do my yoga, and I'm actually training to be a Krav Maga instructor. So I'm training the martial arts, and I try to keep in pretty good shape, yeah. And I watch my diet and nutrition and all that kind of good stuff as well.
Yes, I'm sitting here feeling very self-conscious. What do you see for yourself in the future now? I mean, you've got all these different interests going on. Again, just imagine with us where you're going.
Well, it's interesting. When I created my company, which I created in 2000, underneath which I do all these different things, the three things in my mission statement that I was interested in seeing is development of the individual, development of institutions, and development of systems. And all three are areas of interest of mine, and I've kind of played around in all those areas. What I want to do is continue that type of work. So, you know, I want to spend more time doing the Unbeatable Mind work, working with individuals and groups of individuals and teaching, lecturing, doing curriculum development, all the stuff that I'm doing now, more of that. And I would say that the policy work I do is at the systemic level. But I want to start putting more time into the institutional level, which would be like medicine and education. You know, how do we help transform, or in most cases just reform, some of these institutions to make them more in line with kind of the post-industrial information age values, more humanistic. You might say more spiritual, you know, how they think about people that they actually engage with or the environment in which they work. You know, because we have institutions which no longer serve us. And as I said earlier, we're at this transition time, you know, I want to personally help some of these new institutions emerge which are more sustainable.
One of the things that I'm always surprised by is how much the concepts of the founders of the country allow for that flexibility, how much the emphasis with this bursting new country back in the 1700s, how well they saw that you wanted human beings to have opportunity. You wanted human beings to start with rights and responsibility. And you wanted to have a moral background, an underpinning for this, and that the good society would be one in which government had great limits to it and did interfere as little as possible in its functioning with the human spirit, the entrepreneurial spirit, the freedom spirit. Now, of course, they were still struggling with slavery, and such is politics and human nature. But I think almost all the founders knew in their hearts that that was an evil and had to go. They struggled with it. I think
you're right on. And it's amazing that they came up with the concepts that they did, especially as they were late agricultural age, just the very, very beginning of the industrial age. You know, so they were not fully grokking or grasping the full potential even of the industrial age and what it could mean to human beings and their lives, and yet they still, out of this kind of agricultural system, develop these amazing concepts about human freedom and flourishing.
Yeah, and it's just, I think, so important for people to hear these ideas discussed I think you and I share a profound commitment to the idea of individuality, of freedom, of personal responsibility, and limiting government power over us. Is that that's a fair summary of some of your bedrock beliefs, I imagine?
Yeah, completely, completely.
Yeah.
In fact, you know, I think would be interesting, because you're talking about personal responsibility, as personal rights as well as responsibilities. You know, imagine a culture in which we brought up children not only to think about life that way, but to experience life that way. So, you know, I think about things like, two things come to mind immediately, the democratic free schooling movement and unschooling, and then things like yoga and meditation. So in the democratic free school movement, children, and it's age appropriate, participate in deciding what the rules are, what the punishments are, what the curriculum is, you know, for particular classes in a particular school, which makes them Democrats, not like the Democratic Party, but Democrats in the sense that they are participating, authoring their own lives, but in a collective sense. You know, that's amazing, because that creates a completely different type of human being than someone who's in an authoritarian system like we have today, for the most part, where you go to class, they ring a bell, you go to the next class, they ring a bell, you go to the next class, you sit in rows, you have to raise your hand to speak, and you do that for 12, 14, 16, 18 years, you know, however long you do that for. That system creates a different person than someone who's actually participating and authoring collectively their own experience in an educational setting. So imagine what would be possible if more children were brought up participating in the decisions that affected them, what kind of adults they would be. That's one thing.
Absolutely.
And then I'm thinking yoga or meditation or both. I mean, you know, we have a drug problem in our country. We have, you know, a wide variety of different psychological ailments, including, you know, drug and alcohol abuse. But imagine if our children were taught at a very young age how to manage their own mind-body system, their own nervous system. If they were taught young, most likely, not completely, there would be a lot less of the problems that we face, because they wouldn't need drugs to dull their senses or raise their senses or to alter their consciousness. You know, they would know how to do that to a certain extent, naturally. They know how to manage their mental states and emotional states, which means they could get along better with other people. I mean, that in and of itself brings up a whole new generation of people who are, as you said, self-responsible.
Do you think the early schools did that in a better way? Was there a better time in America when that happened?
Probably not for most people, because, you know, I wouldn't want to have been an African-American 100 years ago or Hispanic-American. You know, there are the racial and ethnic problems. You know, I'm sure we could look back and say that there were some better ways of doing certain things, and we should look back. We should always do that and see how we can integrate them into how we do them presently. But I wouldn't be like a retro romantic and look back and say that, you know, that the 50s were the best time, or the 1830s was the best time. You know, it might have been for a few select people, but not for the majority of people. But we can learn by looking backwards, for sure.
What would you envision in terms of the government role here? Do you want to see free school? Do you want to see schools that are on vouchers? Do you want to see schools that are private? How do you envision this as working out?
One of my critiques of the industrial age is kind of the one size fits all mentality. You know, we need one type of healthcare system, we need one type of education system. I don't think that suits us as human beings. So I would say we don't need one type of system. We need multiple different options, because people are different, cultures are different, subcultures are different, individuals within those cultures are different. They should have as many options as possible. So I would say remove as many barriers as possible, so people can go to private schools. They can try unschooling or deschooling or democratic free schooling. You know, a military school might be really good for one child, and an unschooling experience might be good for another child. You know, and I'm not smart enough to determine who should go where and when.
Yeah.
I just want to see the maximization of freedom so those choices are available to parents and families and children.
You know, by coincidence, my last show last week was with Bob Rose, who is an educator who's been around about as long as I have been, and who described getting rid of the command-control model for his classrooms over many decades and working democratically with the children, including on issues of discipline.
Nice.
And what would be appropriate disciplines. So folks listening to this show who find this interesting would find that the last show with Bob Rose just totally dovetails. And he goes into a lot of real specifics about how he helped nurture responsibility and individuality and a democratic model of relating. You know, one of the things that just struck me is that most people would think that the democratic model and individuality don't mix. So say, and obviously you and I think they do, how do they mix so well in your mind?
Well, you're married, and do you have children?
Oh, yes.
Okay, I assume they're adult children.
Yes.
Okay.
The youngest is 30.
Nice.
So 31
okay.
or 2 now.
So, you know, everyone's part of a family, hopefully, you know, a healthier family than not. But in family, as a social system, we are individuals that's part of a collective. I mean, that's the individual and democratic ideal right there. And you also are part of a workspace or a community organization or a church. Now, there are hierarchies involved in different decision-making systems. But for a lot of folks, for large parts of their day or parts of their day or parts of their week, they're engaged in systems, social systems, in which they act as a democratic whole, but they are individuals within that system. I would actually like to see that. So that's, you know, we do this all the time in our daily life. Now, I would like to see more of that being made conscious in our institutions, in our culture. So, you know, my critique of the state is very similar to my critique of the corporate world. You know, the corporate world, especially large businesses, operate very similarly to how we just described a school system, authoritarian. Now, some of the newer models in business are much, you know, you're collapsing the hierarchies. Not completely, because then you have, you know, if you have a circle and everyone sings kumbaya, nothing gets done. So you have to have some kind of holarchy decision-making system, but one that recognizes the value and differences of the individual, allows them to fulfill, you know, their goals, needs, aspirations, and contributing to the greater good of the company. And there are more and more examples of that, which is fantastic. And as I said earlier, these are just models that we need to replicate, experiment with, and keep the older models from destroying, which I'm afraid, you know, will happen over time if we're not careful.
And it makes me think about Ben Franklin, who is probably the or one of the greatest individualists in the history of the world, who produced on every level. He may have been the greatest scientist of his century or that portion of his century. He was one of the great philanthropists of his time, one of the great inventors, if not the greatest inventor of his time. He was a political thinker. He was a warrior, not with a gun, but as a diplomat. And he was also one of the great Democrats of the Revolution. He actually was against the bicameral notion of a legislature. He wanted a people's legislature. So he was very democratically oriented, and yet with the purpose of democracy was not for the people to run each other's lives, but most importantly, to protect each other's freedoms and then to have a social world in which people aided each other and helped each other, much as he did as a philanthropist.
Yeah,
these
ideas. The basis of human relationships, a better basis than coercion and violence, would be cooperation and care.
Yes, and that is hard to force, as the Marxists have, well, I don't know that they've found out, but as the history of Marxism and communism shows, it's very hard to force cooperation. It grows very well, spontaneously, right, if individual rights are protected.
Exactly. And you can develop the capacity for care, compassion. So you recognize that you're not alone, you're not an island. You're part of a social network, and it's really important that you not only fulfill your own needs and desires and aspirations, but that you also care for your fellow man.
We're going to be ending in about a minute or two, and this has taken a really interesting turn for me. I don't often talk so much about politics. What I particularly love about your approach is exactly your deepest beliefs, which is that there are principles that should be common and that should be understandable across party lines, and that these principles have been part of America for a long time. And going back to the founders, there were people on what might be called the right back then, although that was a very different position back then, and people on the left, but that people work together toward these common goals. My guest, Michael Ostrolenk, Ostrolenk, a most interesting and a very productive person. A pleasure to have you on the show.
Thanks, Peter.